Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I am so very pleased to welcome tonight's author, though I guess if there's a small confession to make, I always have to kind of gear myself up to read her books because I'm a bit of a scaredy cat myself. Okay, I'm a big scaredy cat myself, but it's always worth the time and energy I put to them. She's such a fine writer. Please join me in welcoming Jennifer McMahon.
It is so great to be here at the Tattered Cover again, and it is so great to see all of you here supporting your local independent bookstore, because this is what it's all about, and I wouldn't be here if you guys weren't here and if you guys weren't supporting the bookstore, so I so appreciate it. Hello. So we are here tonight to talk about my new novel, The Night Sister, which is a little creepy for those of you who might not know me or my work. I thought that I would tell you a little bit about the book, a little bit about how I came to write the book, read a little bit from the book, and then I can answer questions if folks have questions. So The Night Sister is my seventh book, which just blows my mind. Don't ask me to list them all because I might forget one. No, I won't say that. So The Night Sister is my seventh book, and it takes place in the 50s. It takes place at a family-run roadside motel in the fictional town of London, Vermont, in the 50s and 60s, 1989, and the present day. In the 50s and 60s, we have two sisters growing up in the motel, Sylvie and Rose. And Sylvie is the older sister, and she's the charismatic one and the one who does really well in school and the one everyone loves. And she's obsessed with Hollywood, and she writes letters to Alfred Hitchcock, and she wants to grow up and be in the movies and go to Hollywood one day. And her sister Rose isn't quite that charismatic and is sort of in Sylvie's shadow. And in the early 60s in Vermont, the interstate came through, as it did in much of the country, and kind of changed the landscape of Vermont, and it changed my fictional town of London, and kind of dried up the town of London and the motel kind of goes under, and things aren't going so well there, and Sylvie disappears soon after. And everyone assumes she's gone off to Hollywood to be rich and famous and be in the movies, but no one ever hears from her again. Dun, dun, dun. And then in 1989, we have Rose's daughter, Sylvie's niece, Amy, growing up at the motel. And now the motel, the Tower Motel by now, has closed in 1971. So in 1989, it's just a relic of what it once was. The roofs are caving in. It's just completely falling apart. No guests ever stop by anymore. But what a cool place to be a kid and grow up, right? You've got all the empty motel rooms to play in. You know, and she knows where the keys are, so she and her friends can go and explore the rooms. And they roller skate in the old pool that's been empty now for a long time. And Amy plays there with her two best friends, Piper and Margot. And one summer they're playing, and they discover something. They find a clue as to what really happened to Sylvie. And the clue tells them that maybe Sylvie didn't go off to Hollywood. Maybe something a little more sinister happened. And they start kind of searching around the motel for other clues. And they discover other secrets about the motel and about Amy's family. And these secrets eventually just destroy their friendship at the end of that summer. Then we have the present day. And Piper and Margot are adults now, and Piper is living in California and gets a call from her sister. And her sister says, something terrible has happened at the old motel. It's Amy. She's dead. Her husband and son are dead. And I think she's left a message for us. And so Piper goes back home and kind of she and her sister have to revisit that summer and try to figure out what on earth it all means and how the secrets they discovered are connected to what's going on now. That's a little bit about the book and how I came to write the book. I'm not one of those writers who sits down and like has an idea and writes this whole complete outline and has a whole book envisioned. It's like little bits and pieces come to me here and there. And several years ago, I was living in the town of Barre, Vermont, which is right. I live in Montpelier now, which is the state capital, and Barre is right next door. And I was living in Barrie, and I heard this story. I heard that Alfred Hitchcock and Shirley MacLaine came to the world premiere of The Trouble with Harry in Barrie, Vermont, at this little theater on Main Street called the Paramount Theater. And I went, what? I mean, Barrie, Vermont is a tiny town in Vermont. And I said, whoa, that can't be true. And I started doing research, and I realized, and I knew that The Trouble with Harry had been filmed in Craftsbury, Vermont. But it was true. They actually came. They had the world premiere at the Paramount Theater, and they had this big state dinner in Barrie, and all the New England governors were there, and all these big wigs from Hollywood came, and they had this big motorcade procession down Main Street, and they had spotlights shining on Main Street. And I told everyone I knew, I told all my Barrie friends and neighbors, did you know Alfred Hitchcock and Shirley MacLaine were in Barrie? And they said, are you high? What do you mean? No. And I was like, it's true. And he even signed the wall of the Paramount Theater, which is still standing there today, but they painted over it. Can you imagine that? I know. What's up with that? Seriously. I don't know if they thought that it was a fake or they didn't know who it was. Who's Alfred Hitchcock? I don't know. I don't know what the story is with how they painted over it, but... So I told people that, and I thought, I would love to just put that in a book somehow. And I didn't really have an idea for what to do with it, so I kind of stuck it in the back of my mind and held on to the idea and went on with my life. And down the road from me, from not far from where I live, there's this old, creepy motel. And it's set back up on a hill, and there's like a farmhouse. It's called Ann's Motel, and there are two units of motel rooms. And I came to Vermont in the late 80s, and it's been closed since I've been there. And every year, you know, you drive by, and it's a little more dilapidated. And there was a man living there in the house. And I heard from all the locals that this was the son of Ann, and that he lived there still. Ann had passed on, but this man still lived there. And I thought, whoa, and my imagination starts going places, and I'm thinking, what must it be like to live in this old abandoned motel and maybe to have grown up in the motel and to see the town change? And a couple years ago, I was at a yard sale. A friend of mine was having a yard sale. And who shows up but son of Ann, motel guy. And I'm there, and I do what all writers do. And I kind of get a little closer, and I eavesdrop, because he's talking about the motel, and he's talking about what it's like to live there. And he said, yeah, you know, things were going really well until the interstate came through, and that ruined us. And I went, ha-ha. And I thought, I'm going to set a book at a creepy roadside motel in Vermont, and I'm going to have two sisters who grow up there, and I'm going to show what happens when the interstate comes through and when the highway comes through and how that dries up the town and how that ruins things, and creepy things are going to happen because I'm me. But immediately, what does that bring me around to? Alfred Hitchcock, right? I come full circle, because what happens at the Bates Motel in Psycho? Norman says, you know, that we were used to be busy, and then the highway came through, and look what happened to Norman. So that brought me back, and I thought, oh, I'll have two sisters, and one of them will be obsessed with Hollywood, and one of them will write letters to Alfred Hitchcock, and I'll be able to put that Alfred Hitchcock scene, because they're going to go to Barrie and see Alfred Hitchcock and Shirley MacLaine, and it's going to, like, change this young girl's life. She's going to be a girl when she goes. It's going to be this, like, pivotal moment in her life, because she's going to see this amazing director and movie star in this little town in Vermont, and think anything is possible, and everything's going to be wonderful. But it's, you know, not really, because something's going to happen to her. I'll have her grow up, and she'll disappear, and everyone will think she ran away to Hollywood. But that won't be what happens, because that's too nice. And I thought, so what's going to happen to Sylvie? What can I make happen to Sylvie? And I'm thinking, I'm writing the book, and I'm getting all engrossed in the atmosphere of creating the motel. And when all else fails and when you're stuck, go to 9 and 10-year-old girls for inspiration. It was summer, and my daughter was 9 at the time, and she has two twin cousins who are 10, a year older than her. And they were spending a week with us, and they are very interested in what I'm doing all the time. And the twins just love that I write books and always ask me a million questions. What are you working on? What's it like? What are you going to make happen next? And so I tell them about my story, and I said, so I've got these two girls, and they're growing up at this motel, and one of them really wants to be a movie star, and she disappears, and everyone thinks she went off to Hollywood, but that's not what happens. What do you guys think should happen? And they came up with some great ideas. We had, like, serial killer, alien abduction, like, maybe she turned into a man and became transgender. Like, we had all kinds of fun, crazy suggestions. And I wasn't really sure what to do. And then the conversation turned, as it often does with that age group, to monsters. And we were talking about the things that scared us the most. And the girl said to me, well, you know what the scariest monster is? I said, no, tell me. And I'm thinking, like, you know, Dracula, vampire, because they're all vampire obsessed. No, it wasn't vampires. They said, It's an SW. We can't say the name out loud, because if we say the name out loud, there might be one in the room or one around, and it will hear us and come and get us. So you can't say the name out loud. I'm like, SW, what is that? And I'm, so I'm going to take a chance and say the name out loud and hope that no one in this audience is an SW, because you might come get me. I'm going to go back to my hotel tonight and lock the door, double lock the doors. An SW stands for a skinwalker. And the girls inform me that skinwalkers can appear as human beings during the day, and they can be your best friend, your neighbor, your sister, your mother. But at night, they turn into something evil. They turn into this horrible monster capable of terrible things. And I loved this idea. And I thought, wow, what if my young sister in the 50s and 60s, what if Rose is absolutely convinced that her perfect, charismatic, gonna be a movie star sister isn't what she seems? What if Rose is absolutely convinced that Sylvie is actually a monster, that she turns into a monster at night and goes off and does terrible things, then sneaks back to her bed in the morning? And what if she wakes up several times in the night and Sylvie's gone? And this is the only explanation Rose has. And Rose just is determined to prove this, no matter what. And of course, no one's going to believe her because Sylvie's so perfect. And I told the girls this idea. I said, "What, Kim? What do you guys think?" And they loved it. And I knew I was onto something. And then the cousins, my nieces, looked at me and they said, "But Aunt Jennifer, is Sylvie really a monster?" And I said, "I don't know. I have to write the book to find out." And now you all have to read the book to find out. So that's a little bit about how I came to write The Night Sister. I thought I could read a little bit. So as I said, the book kind of goes back and forth in time. And I've got present day stuff. I've got Sylvie's letters to Hitchcock. The 50s and 60s storyline is told by Rose. But then I've also got Sylvie's point of view just through the letters to Hitchcock. And, you know, Sylvie writes her letters to Alfred Hitchcock the way that some people keep a diary or a journal. You know, that's who she confides in and tells her secrets to, is Alfred Hitchcock. But, of course, because who wouldn't? If he were alive, I would be writing him letters now and telling him all my secrets. So I thought I would start and be a little unoriginal and start at the very beginning of the book. And so this is the very opening of the book. And this is the present day. And this is Amy. And this is the only part that we hear from Amy. This is the only time that we hear anything from Amy's point of view. Amy's heart hammers, and her skin is slick with sweat. "Focus," she tells herself. "Don't think about the thing in the tower." Amy knows that if she thinks too hard about it, she won't be able to do what needs to be done. She looks down at the photo, the old black and white print she's kept all these years, hidden away in the drawer of her bedside table. It's been handled so much that it's cracked and faded, one of the corners torn. In it, her mother, Rose, and her Aunt Sylvie are young girls wearing crisp summer dresses as they stand in front of a sign that says, "World Famous London Chicken Circus." Each girl clutches a worried-looking hen, but that's where the similarities end. Amy's mother is wearing a scowl beneath tired eyes, her hair dark and unkempt. Sylvie is radiant, the one who is going to grow up and go to Hollywood. Her blonde hair is movie star perfect. Her eyes are shining. Someone has scrawled a date on the back, June 1955. If only Amy could travel back in time, talk to those two girls, warn them what was coming. Warn them that one day it would lead to this moment. Amy, alone and out of options, on the verge of doing something terrible. She bites her lip and wonders what people will say about her when she's gone. That she was broken inside, a woman with a screw loose. Aren't all women like that, really? Little time bombs waiting. Especially women like her, surviving on monthly boxes from the food pantry, dressing her children in ragged secondhand clothes that never quite fit. What went wrong? They will whisper to each other while fondling artichokes and avocados in the produce aisle of the grocery store. What kind of monster was she? They might ask after a few glasses of wine as they sit in tidy living rooms gathered for book club. But these people know nothing of true monsters. They will never have to make the choices Amy has made. The fluorescent lights in the kitchen buzz and flicker. Amy takes a deep breath, looks out the kitchen window. Beyond the gravel driveway, past the two ruined motel buildings with their sagging, sway-backed roofs, the tower leans precariously. Made of cement and stone, it was built by her grandfather all those years ago as a gift for her grandmother, Charlotte, her own Tower of London. Amy thinks, as she often does, of that long ago summer when she was 12, of Piper and Margot and the day they found the suitcase, of how after that nothing was ever the same. Where was Piper now? Out in California somewhere, surrounded by palm trees and glamorous people, living a life Amy couldn't imagine. Amy suddenly longs to talk to her, to confide in her and ask for forgiveness, to say, "Don't you see this is what I have to do?" She thinks Piper and Margot might understand if she could tell them the whole story, starting with the suitcase and working forward. But mostly, what she wishes is that she could find a way to warn them. She glances at the old photo in her hand, takes a black marker from a kitchen drawer, and hastily writes a message along the bottom over the chickens and patterned summer dresses. Then she tucks the photograph into her back pocket and goes to the window. The clock on the stove says 12:15 a.m. Down at the tower, a shadow lurches from the open doorway. She's out of time. Moving into the hallway, she latches the deadbolt on the front door. Silly, really. A locked door will do no good. Then stops at the closet and grabs her grandfather's old Winchester. Rifle in hand, she climbs the stairs, the same stairs she's climbed her whole life. She thinks she can hear young Piper and Margot following behind her, whispering, warning her, telling her, as they did all those years ago, to forget all about it, that there is no 29th room. Amy takes each step slowly, willing herself not to run, to stay calm and not wake her family. What would Mark think if he woke up and found his wife creeping up the steps with a gun? Poor, sweet, clueless Mark. Perhaps she should have told him the motel secrets. But no, it was better to protect him from it all as best she could. The scarred wood beneath her feet creaks, and she thinks of the rhyme her grandmother taught her. When death comes knocking on your door, you'll think you've seen his face before. When he comes creeping up your stairs, you'll know him from your dark nightmares. If you hold up a mirror, you shall see that he is you, and you are he. So that's Amy. Yeah, and I thought I'd read, I thought I would read the first letter that Sylvie writes to Alfred Hitchcock. Okay. Mr. Alfred Hitchcock, Paramount Pictures, Hollywood, California, June 3rd, 1955. Dear Mr. Hitchcock, my name is Sylvia Slater, and I am 11 years old. I live in London, Vermont, where my family runs the Tower Motel on Route 6. I get top marks in my class, and my teacher, Mrs. Olson, says I am already reading and writing at a high school level. Daddy is teaching me to help with the bookkeeping, and sometimes he even lets me write the daily tallies in our big ledger. I want to be an actress when I grow up, or maybe even a movie director like you. Are there any girl movie directors? My sister Rose, she says she doesn't think there are, but she's only 8. I don't mind telling you, Rose is a little odd. She watches me all the time, and it's starting to bother me. Mama says Rose is just jealous. My father says Rose has an overactive imagination. I honestly can't imagine what goes on in her head. She runs around the motel in torn dresses, tangles in her hair, and her best friend on earth is a sad old cow we have named Lucy. And yet she has the nerve to tell me I'm silly for wanting to be an actress one day? I've started keeping a movie scrapbook filled with pictures I've cut out of famous actors and actresses. Sometimes I show my Uncle Fenton what I've pasted in my book. You are his favorite director. He's seen every one of your pictures. It was his idea that I write to you, because I have an idea for a movie. But I have to warn you, it's really scary. My Oma, she's my mama's mother, came to visit last year all the way from England. Oma told me and Rose terrible, frightening stories. Rose loved the stories, but I hated them. They gave me nightmares. She told one story that I'll never forget, because she swore it was true. It's the scariest thing I've ever heard. Mr. Hitchcock, before I tell you any more, there is something I need to know. Do you believe in monsters? Sincerely yours, Miss Sylvia A. Slater, The Tower Motel, 328 Route 6, London, Vermont. So that's the first letter to Hitchcock. Yes, and I could read a little more. I could answer questions. Do folks have questions? I love taking questions. Questions are good, because I find that there's always things that people want to know that I don't go over when I'm talking. And yes, in the back, in the red shirt. Did Hitchcock write back is the question. No, she never hears from Hitchcock, and she does not even know if he is getting her letters, but she believes that he is, and she continues to write them for years until she disappears when she's 19. So, yes, she writes for years, and she just keeps on writing, and we, yes.
So you have, your answer comes to you as you go. Do you ever scare yourself writing late at night?
The question is, do I ever scare myself? And I love this question because, yes, I scare myself to death. I, you know, in spite of writing really creepy stories, I am a big scaredy cat. I really am. I'm very easily frightened. I'm the person who, like, hears the weird noise in the woods and completely freaks out. I'm reading a scary book at night in my house, and I have to go through the house and turn every single light on, and I can't go to sleep, and I have to open the closet doors because I'm sure something's in there. I have to look under the bed and make sure there's nothing hiding. It's like being a little kid. I'm terrified, and when I'm writing, I actually, you know, I get chills. I feel like someone's in the room, and this whole, like, writing about monsters thing freaked me out completely, especially when I was under the inspiration of these little girls who are convincing me that there are totally monsters in the world, and they're walking among us, and you don't know they're monsters. That's the scariest thing about them. I'm like, oh my God, that's terrible. That's way worse than the monsters that you know are monsters and are out there hiding. Because you, yeah. And I'm looking kind of askance at everyone I know, thinking, oh, are you a monster? Yeah, I don't know. And yeah, no, I scare myself all the time, and I think that's part of what drives me to write. Is I love to write about the things that scare me and the things that keep me up. I'm also a terrible insomniac. I have really bad dreams, and I scare myself. You know, I wake up from a dream, and I start thinking about it, and I just start obsessing about the scary dream I've had, and I start thinking, that could be real, and I'm working myself up into a panic. And so I just turn on the light, and I write it all down, and I get to share my fears and my nightmares with you all, and it makes me feel better. Yes. Okay. So the question is, when I start writing down, when I'm actually composing my books, what do I use, a computer or longhand, and what's my favorite method? I usually am writing with a computer. That said, I get stuck sometimes, and I find one of the best things I can do is to turn the computer off and write longhand. And I'll show you. Hang on. I have this old school composition book, and I carry them ever. I'm actually a graph paper fan, so I buy the graph paper ones. But I carry a composition book ever with me. There's one next to my bed at night, And I just, it's my writer's notebook. I write all my scary thoughts and all my silly thoughts and all my thoughts in it. And when I'm sitting in front of the computer and a scene just isn't working or I'm not getting a character's voice right, I'll pull out my notebook and my pen and I'll just try writing that way. And it's like a different part of your brain, you know, like writing longhand engages some different part of the creative process, I think, and it can get me unstuck. Absolutely. And my last book, The Winter People, I did diary entries from a woman, Sarah, and I had to write all the diary entries out longhand. It just didn't work doing it in front of the computer. It didn't feel very authentic. Sylvie types her letters to Hitchcock, so I ended up typing those. Not actually typing on a typewriter, although that would have been cool, wouldn't it? But yeah, and I also, you know, another thing that I do when I'm feeling stuck is sometimes I put away my notebook and my computer and I have big sheets of newsprint and I get out colored Sharpies and I do like mind mapping. I just start writing down all these different ideas and I kind of go crazy and I draw pictures and I do a lot to get unstuck because I get stuck quite a bit. I have a lot of tricks to get myself unstuck. Yes. Oh, that question is so hard. Out of the novels? Out of the novels I've written, which one is my favorite and scariest? This one might be the scariest. I would say this one or The Winter People, but I think this one might be scarier. I'm not sure. It depends on what scares you. Like, it scared me quite a bit. I think my books get scarier as I go along. As for my favorite is always... My favorite is usually Which One Is Out Now, which is The Night Sister, because I'm so wrapped up in this world and I'm thinking about it. But I also have to go back to my very first book, Promise Not to Tell, just because it was my first book and it's kind of like, I don't know, I have a special attachment to it because it was the first book that was published. And I don't know that it's my best book, but I think it's special in my heart because it was the one that did it and got me into the world of publishing. And the first one of seven so far, and hopefully many more, knock on wood. Yes?
Are any of your books sequels?
Are any of my books sequels? No. I don't know that I have the attention span to do sequels or a series. But I always have that idea, you know, and especially when I get so much feedback from readers sometimes, they're like, oh, you know, you should do something with this person, And I was actually at an event for this book, Night Sister, and someone was like, well, you should do a prequel and write about like the parents who built the motel and write about Oma, the Charlotte's mother in Europe. And I got kind of excited about that. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going to say never. So anything's possible in the future. But I have the sense when I'm done writing a book that I have tortured my characters a lot. I've really put them through the wringer, and I kind of need to let them have some breathing room and rest for a while, and I don't want to torture them anymore. But I think about them still. Even my first book, Promise Not to Tell, I still think about my protagonist, Kate, and I wonder, you know, I think of my characters the way that people think of their old college friends. Like, I wonder how they're doing, And, you know, like, oh, did Kate ever get together with Nikki? What's going on? They're, like, real to me on some level. And I think about them and I worry about them. And maybe that makes me a little kind of off in the head, but that's okay. I can live with it. Yes.
Do you talk to your characters when you're writing?
Do I talk to my characters when I'm writing? Not usually out loud, but in my head sometimes. And sometimes I do have like little dialogues with them. And my daughter will come in and she's like, Mom, you're talking to yourself again. And it's worse when I'm like in the grocery store doing it. And my daughter's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I was thinking about something I wanted. And my character was saying to another character and I just said it out loud. But one thing that I do when I'm working on a character, when I'm doing like a character sketch and I'm trying to get to know the character, is I'll interview them. And I'll sit down and I'll ask them a series of questions. And I always do this longhand in my notebook. And I ask them a series of questions and I have them answer. And I have to hear their voice in my head. And I kind of do this exercise until I can get their voice clear in my head and until I really have a real sense of them. And I'll ask questions like, you know, like what kind of shoes do you wear? I'll ask questions like boring questions like that. But one of the questions that I always ask and it just really helps me get into the characters and it always surprises me the answers I get, is what's the one thing you've never told anyone? And I learn a lot when I ask my characters that. And the things that just come, they speak to me. I hear voices. And really, and so I'll do this like character interview thing until I have not only a sense of them, but I really clearly hear their voice in my head. You know, like I hear the way that they speak. And when I've got that, then I know that I've got this character down and I can really write about them and I can really figure out, you know, what's in another thing I ask, what's the thing on my character? What do you want most? What are you most afraid of? That kind of stuff. And that all works its way onto the page. But yeah, it's kind of like dating, only not as hard. You had a question. So the question is, have I ever considered writing from a male point of view? And I've done a little bit in Dismantled. I wrote from a man's point of view. And then I did Martin in my last book, The Winter People. And I loved writing Martin. I got very attached to Martin. I haven't written a whole book from a male point of view yet. But that may change. For some reason, and I'm sure like a therapist could tell you, why I'm just completely drawn, and I have a really easy time writing about these young, quirky, kind of somewhat off young adolescent girls who are very imaginative and have their issues. And part of my brain is probably stuck back there. And I struggle when it comes to writing. It's the adults I struggle to write. And getting the young female voices is much easier for me. But the two men that I've written from their points of view, I really enjoyed, and I feel like I would do it again. And I'm actually working on something now that has a couple of male points of view. It's got a lot of different points of view. I don't know what's going to end up staying, but and I'm really drawn to the idea of trying to write from a kid, a boy's point of view. Yeah, so I'm going to give it a try. Absolutely. Yes. That's a hard, but what would I like them to put on my gravestone? Gosh. I don't know. I have never thought about that. She did the best she could. I don't know. She loved a good creepy story. I don't know. That's a good question to ask your characters. Oh, I'm going to start asking my characters. That's a good point. That is a good question to ask my characters. I'm going to start asking my characters that. I just thought that I would be burned and have my ashes dumped somewhere, and I know. But now we're getting really morbid. I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that. That's, yeah. Ooh. Yes. Have I always made up my characters, or are they inspired by people? My characters are always made up, but they definitely contain bits and pieces of people I've known or seen or heard about or read about in the newspaper. I know writers, and I have friends who are writers who write like this character is very much based on this person, and you can tell when you read it. And I can't do that because it's more fun to make things up. Yeah. Made up people are far more interesting than regular people because you can take, you know, little bits and pieces and build a really messed up person. Yes.
How much time do you give yourself between writing books, or do you just kind of go from one idea to the next and you tell the story?
How much time do I give myself between writing books? I don't ever really take a break. I think of it, it's almost like cooking. So I've got the book that I'm currently working on, and that's on the front burner, and I'm putting most of my energy into that. But then I've always got other things simmering. And when I get stuck on the thing that I'm working on, I'll sometimes my editors probably wouldn't like to hear this now because I'm on deadline. I'm supposed to be turning in a draft of my next book at the end of this month. But sometimes, maybe in the past, possibly, I have put away the book I'm supposed to be working on because I get an idea for a new book or I'm really excited about something. So right now, I'm working on a book that I'm supposed to be finishing, and I've got two or three other ideas bubbling in various stages of completion. You know, I've gotten several chapters into a couple different things. And you know, it's a process. So I'll write a draft. Like, I'm going to get this draft done, and I'm going to get it to my editors by the end of this month, one way or another. And once I turn it in, then I'm going to have downtime, although it's not really downtime, but then I won't have the book in my hands anymore. I'll be waiting to hear their feedback and the feedback from my agent before I dive back into that. And while I'm doing that, I'll work on something else. I'll pull one of the things from the back burner to the front and put my energy into that. And I get really cranky if I'm not working on something. It's like, I don't know, I get headachy and grouchy, and it's like I have the flu. And, you know, my family knows if I'm, like, not working on something, like, oh, you need to work because I'm a miserable to be around. I really am. I'm happiest when I'm writing at least a little bit every day, even when I'm on vacation. It's, I don't know, it's what I love, you know, other than my friends and my family, it's what I love most. And I just feel incredibly lucky that I get to do what I love most and, like, make a living from it. I get to stay home and do it. I get to invent these people and see what lives they're going to lead and see where they're going to take me every day when I turn on the computer. And that's, like, the coolest job in the world. I love it. I love it. Other questions? Yes. Oh, that's a good question. If I know my characters' voices so well, do I ever find myself speaking as them or answering a question the way they would? Not usually. Like, they don't take over me. I'm not, like, possessed by them yet. That hasn't happened. I do sometimes ask myself, what would so-and-so do in this situation? Yeah, when I'm faced with certain life situations, I do, and I'm rarely wrapped up in a book, I'm like, well, this is what I'm probably going to do, but what would this person do? It's just, it's something I think about, but I don't ever, like, do I ever do what that person would do? Not in my normal waking life. So I imagine it. No, I'm not that. No, not yet. I was on a panel once with the writer MJ Rose, who's a really wonderful person, and she told this great story. She was talking about getting to know her characters, and she fills like whole notebooks. She does these intense character studies before she starts working on a book and while she's working on a book. And she said that she will go shopping. She lives in New York, and she will go into the city and go shopping as her character. And she will buy the things that her character would buy. And she said that her house is full of things, like little pieces of jewelry and a pen and shirts and things that, like, her characters have bought, or she has bought as her characters. And I thought that was kind of cool. I wouldn't do that, but I thought it was really cool. I thought it was a neat idea. I've definitely sort of walked through the world trying to imagine, you know, what my character would see and what they would be doing. I might go shopping. I might be in a store and think, oh, so-and-so would like that, but I wouldn't actually buy it because I'm me and they're them, and what would I do with it? I don't know. So far, I blur the lines enough. I don't need to go that far. I have enough of an identity crisis every day. Well, that's been awesome. Thank you all so much for coming, and thanks to Tattered Cover, and I'll be hanging out after, and you can ask questions that you didn't want to ask in front of people, and I'm happy to sign books. And thank you all so much. Yay, this was really fun. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.